The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Laboring to raise these children up to be conformed to the image of Christ, and we all have great faith in the power of this form of education, Lord, and of the value of logic, and I ask that those who have come here today would be blessed by this, that they would learn something and be able to take it back. I ask for clarity of thought and speech as I seek to relay these things to them, and we commit this to you. And we pray it in Christ's name. Amen. Well, thanks for coming. My name is Bradley Finkbeiner, and I am a teacher at Rockbridge Academy, which is in Millersville, Maryland. I've been there for 12 years now. I taught logic for 10 of those years. And when I first started, I was heavily oriented towards formal logic. I taught propositional calculus and a lot of symbolic logic. And I think about the distribution of emphasis that I gave to, say, formal logic versus informal versus definition. And it looked sort of like a pyramid with formal logic on the bottom. Most of the emphasis went to that, and then informal in the middle, and then definition on the top. And as I grew as a teacher and started thinking about the frame of the students and about my own experiences arguing, I teach debate class and philosophy class, and then I just like to argue with my friends outside of class, I realized that there was a bit of a discrepancy between what I was focusing on in class and what I was doing outside of class, or frankly, inside of class and other classes. What I mean by that is I spent a great deal of time teaching them formal logic, which has huge value, and I don't want to downplay that at all. It's indispensable. But I wasn't giving them enough emphasis on definition, and yet in my own experience, I felt that definition is primarily what I found myself engaged in discussion, in debate, in evaluating argument. So part of what I want to do here today is defend that contention to show why definition is so important, and hopefully for those of you who might be overly biased towards formal logic, maybe this will offer some bit of a correction to that. All right, well, I teach my kids that logic can be divided into three major sections: a semantic section, inferential, and evidential. And for any argument you're evaluating, you can ask these three questions. The semantic question is, what do the terms in the argument mean? The inferential question, having to do with inference, is asking whether the conclusion follows from the premises. The evidential question is asking whether the premises are true. It's called the evidential question because to answer the truth value, you always have to appeal to evidence to support. I want to go over some examples of where this becomes important, the role of the semantic question in evaluating the inferential and evidential questions. I'm going to focus on a formal argument. Some of you will recognize this as modus ponens. It's a formal argument. It's valid. You can put variables in there and say something like, if A, then B, A, therefore B. But obviously, we have content here. This is a formal argument, but definition, I would say, is even more relevant in evaluating informal argument. I'm not going to talk about that today just because I ran out of time and I had to cut that for my presentation. But informal argument, by definition, doesn't have to do with the form, but rather the what? The content, right? The content. Well, guess what? The content is semantic. It's linguistic. You're talking about concepts and the relationship between concepts. So when you're doing informal fallacies, for instance, ad verecundium or whatever it might be, you are always deep inside of semantic issues. And the study of definition, therefore, will feed back onto your study of informal logic to add a great deal of power to your ability to assess informal logic. But let's just look at this argument. Those of you who know logic realize that this is valid regardless of the content. Again, if A, then B, A, therefore B. I don't have to have any content. But what's sometimes not emphasized is that first premise. That first premise expresses an inference of its own. If you look at the first claim, the antecedent, evolution is true. The second claim, the biblical creationism is false. The relationship expressed by the if-then is an inference. If this is the case, then somehow, some way, this other thing follows from it. Okay? But it's that following that I want to explore on a semantic level here. Before I go back to that argument, look at this one. If all fathers are male, then no fathers are non-male. Number two, if all fathers are male, then most fathers watch martial arts movies. The first one is true, you might say, by definition or even by the form, the structure of the argument, whereas the second one is not. And what's interesting, though, is we know that partly or even primarily because of the terms used. Okay? And I'm going to talk about the significance of this. I'm going to go back to this one momentarily. So, if I'm evaluating this argument, is that first premise true? Does biblical creationism, the falsity of biblical creationism follow from the truth of evolution, supposing that were the case? Well, guess what? It depends on what we mean. It depends on what we mean by those terms. On the left, you see five different textbook definitions. These are textbook, biology textbook definitions. This comes from Stephen Meyer from the Discovery Institute. Any one of these definitions could be in mind when someone's using the word evolution. And by the way, there are more than this. Likewise, for biblical creationism, are we thinking about the calendar theory, the gap theory, the day-age theory, or any of these others, the analogical, the framework, the revelatory theory? Which ones do we have in mind? Right? Trying to answer the question of whether that first premise is true from the evolution and biblical creationism argument is virtually impossible until what? Until you establish which meaning is in view in that first premise. Let's go, and we're going to talk about the different interpretations of how it affects our assessment of this. But look at this again. Here are those two statements. The first one is what's called by many an analytic truth, and it's confirmable or verifiable in an a priori way. That is to say, apart from going out and looking at how the world is. I'm simplifying, but it's helpful. The second one is generally called a synthetic truth, and it's confirmable a posteriori by going out and looking at how the world is to verify it. The first one, if all fathers are male, then no fathers are non-male, doesn't really lend itself to debate because the meaning is such that we all get the conclusion, we get the consequent follows. But the second one, also because of semantic reasons, by the way, it's a mistake to think the first one's just semantic and the second one's not. The second one is entirely semantical because what do we mean by fathers, by male, by most, by movies, by martial art? Those symbols are meaningless to someone who doesn't speak English, right? They're meaningless. It's jibber-jabber. We happen to speak English, so we make the mistake of thinking this is oh so clear. But even for us English speakers, it's not oh so clear. Because what does most mean, for instance? 51%? 80%? Right? What does watch mean? One movie? Two movies? How many movies? If you were to try to verify this, how many movies would be relevant? What is a martial arts movie? Are we talking about the old kung fu theater movies from the 70s, or are we talking about maybe a Jason Bourne movie? What are we talking about here? How would you verify that statement until you what? Yeah, it takes time, it takes patience, it's annoying to a lot of people. This is why Socrates was called the gadfly, because it's irritating to stop and what do you mean by that? My colleague was taking a jab at me because I'm always going after these sorts of questions, and it's not to show off or to cause trouble, it's because I don't know oftentimes what people mean when they use the words they mean. In fact, I don't know what I mean sometimes when I catch myself using certain slogans and terms, and I'll talk about that momentarily as well. Okay, for if evolution is true, then biblical creationism is true. Going to the first premise, if evolution is true, then biblical creationism is false. Let's go back and look at options. If we're talking about evolution in sense 5 and biblical creationism in sense 1, then the answer is yes, it's true. If evolution is true, then biblical creationism is false in these senses, right? But what if we're talking about, I don't know, let's think about one here. What if we're talking about evolution in sense 3 and biblical creationism in sense 1? I think a lot of you would say that's not true. In fact, it doesn't follow anymore. I guess that would be something like microevolution in sense 3. Or certainly evolution in sense 1. Does anyone have an issue with that? Right? So what sense are we talking about here when we look at it? And we are so quick to jump on arguments and say, no, you're wrong, or without first stopping to define what the person means by a term. So the meaning of those terms will affect the inference. That's my point. It's going to affect the inference of premise 1. But go to premise 2 now. Evolution is true. Here's where the semantic question collides or bumps up against the evidential question, right? In a more obvious way, evolution is true. Well, going back to those definitions of evolution, what kind of evidence would be necessary to establish evolution since 1? Pretty simple, right? You don't have to be a scientist even to establish evolution since 1. Does anyone take issue with that? No. What about since 2, changes in the frequencies of alleles in the gene pool of a population? That's fairly common sense. That's something that, say, artificial selection's already breeding. We get that from breeding, right? We understand this truth from breeding. But as you go down the list, guess what? The evidential demand, the burden, grows. The support that's needed is going to increase dramatically as you go down those different meanings of evolution. And so going to the question, is evolution true, premise 2, who knows? What meaning of evolution do you have in mind? Right? All right. Here is a chart, it's a flow chart I give to my students. It's a little bit artificial, I grant it, but it's helpful. You have a copy of that. I'm trying to just teach them the priority, what I consider the logical priority of the semantic question. There's a sense in which when you first ask that question, the top left there, of what the premises mean, you can end the process because you don't know what's meant. You don't know what's meant by these terms. And so there's not a whole lot of point in going on in some context. So you can stop. But if you do know, then hopefully you know enough to determine if the conclusion follows. And for those of you who study logic, you know that a conclusion can follow necessarily or only probably, and so that's deductive and inductive, roughly speaking. And then, depending on which one it is, you can ask whether it's successful or not. If it's successful and deductive, it's valid. If it's unsuccessful, it's invalid. If it's a successful inductive, it's strong, otherwise it's weak. And then you go on to ask the evidential question. Are the premises true? If so, then that's either going to be sound or cogent, depending on whether it's deductive or inductive. The point, though, here is understanding that the semantic issue drives the train of argument all the way through these other aspects, the inferential and evidential. I want to give some reasons for why I think the semantics is important in addition to what I've already presented. In personal experience, we all have fallen prey to using words or slogans that we don't fully understand, or people use them against us. I'll never forget a time I was being cross-examined by someone on my view of the law and the gospel, and whether I thought law and grace were opposed to each other. And I'd studied this a bit, so I knew that there were various meanings of those terms. And so I said, well, what do you mean by law and grace? Long pause. Long, awkward, uncomfortable pause. And then the person moved on to the next question. They didn't know what that meant. They didn't know what they were asking me. It was a formal cross-examination. They were asking me, do I think law and grace are opposed? And they didn't know what they meant by their own question. I've had that happen numerous times. And I'm sure I've been guilty of it myself. Think about how many times we enter into disputes and go on for a half hour, maybe even an hour, only to realize later on that we actually agree with each other because we didn't stop to ask the simple question of what do you mean by those terms? Or here's what I mean. Definition is so important for avoiding that kind of waste and for getting to clarity and unity much quicker. In counseling, obviously as educators, we think of ourselves as academics, but we're also educating the hearts of these children. We're counselors in a lot of ways. And think about how many times semantics enters into a counseling session, whether it's a formal counseling session or with your students. I've had a lot of kids come up to me. What do you think Christian liberty is, Mr. Finkbeiner? What's Christian liberty? What does that mean? Depending on my answer, you know, their lives could be affected. It has direct bearing on whether they're going to drink or smoke or watch this movie or that movie or listen to this or dress this way or that way, right? That's a semantic issue. It's a substantive issue, but you can't get to the substance apart from going through the semantics, right? Look at these terms. I lead a youth group in my home, and we typically explore topics like this. And our conversations are rich, but sometimes they flail. Sometimes they're highly enlightening, but it's almost always, either way, determined by definition, by conceptual analysis, by looking at the various meanings and trying to get clear. And it's not just intellectual gymnastics. It's for the purpose of figuring out what does it mean to be forgiven? What is gossiping? Am I gossiping if I'm talking about a student in a humiliating way to another teacher? Right? Definition answers those sorts of questions. And our aptitude for, our ability to think along semantic lines is going to greatly enhance our ability to counsel, to teach. Let me move on to some theological issues. A student of ours just wrote her thesis on the grounds for divorce, and she said there were two, sexual immorality and desertion, and she went to sexual immorality in Jesus' teaching, the Greek word is porneia, and she argued that sexual immorality is physical sexual contact with another person. But that's a semantic claim, and depending on how you interpret that, you're going to have different kinds of evidential burdens, right? Could porneia be perhaps looking at pornography? Could porneia be emotional unfaithfulness? Could porneia be, right? We can have these sorts of discussions. Those are semantic, and guess what? Highly determinative of how people live their lives, right? If you're counseling someone considering divorce for their husband looking at pornography, and they're saying that's porneia, what are you going to do there? It's time to get busy and start thinking logically about these terms and how to ground them into the scriptures and so on. And debate. Or actually, here, this slide is on the cultural concepts that we wrestle with. Our most recent speaker did a wonderful job talking about engaging our culture. Just take a few seconds to look at that list. Have you ever argued about those? Those are volatile terms, no doubt, but loaded with significance and practical bearing on our lives. And we as Christians have to be ready to engage people when they use these terms. Debates. These are some topics we've debated in my school. Is America a Christian nation? Was the First Crusade a just war? Should teenagers be punished as adults? Every case, when I was helping the students form their debate, so much of our time was spent trying to hammer the possible semantic range, of these terms, because until we could figure that out, we couldn't really establish which arguments would be most relevant. Because depending on how you define the terms, you could literally have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different positions that you're trying to argue. And you had to anticipate, by the way, all those different possibilities from your opponent. That's called topicality in debate. How are they going to define the terms? And depending on how the opponent defined the terms, oftentimes they would win the debate and certainly put the greater burden on their opponent in doing that. In thesis, I can't tell you how many students have gone months into their thesis project. We spend about a year in the junior and senior level working on these wonderful arguments where they have to take a thesis statement and defend it and research it. I have so many students who will go months not understanding what they mean by their thesis statement. And they're looking for arguments, but they don't know their thesis statement yet. I just had one recently, the very last month of the project, and as a result of sitting down with him, we realized that he was only arguing for a little piece of his thesis, and that a lot of the terminology in the thesis was irrelevant, or we should say the arguments of his paper were irrelevant to the bulk of the thesis. Here is a thesis statement from a person that, as you can tell, forced him all over the map of argumentation. A man's romantic relationship with a woman should exist only with a view to marriage, with the approval of the father, in accordance with the familial covenant, biblical wisdom, and a worldview centered on glorifying God. There really should just be, that first comma should probably be a period. Right? But by adding with the approval of the father, that's a new proposition, and it requires support for itself. That could be two theses. In accordance with the familial covenant, there's a third proposition. I'm not sure what that means. Biblical wisdom. Now, the rest of this could be considered maybe just a truism that doesn't need to be added, or maybe it has some significance. It's not clear. But in any case, he's greatly growing the burden here of. He's got 3, 4, possibly 5 different theses rolled into one. And that's going to, if he's logical and thinking about proving that whole thing that you have here, he's going to be all over the map, and his paper is going to grow from 15 to 30 odd pages. And we're going to keep on telling him, no, crunch it back. But I can't get all the support for this huge thing in 50. Well, then what needs to change? Tighten it up, focus it up, get clear in your use of terms. All right. I want to talk with you now a little bit about the next point in the outline here. Roman numeral 3. So far, I have been assuming a distinction between types and tokens that I think is very important to teach our students and get them used to structuring their own thinking. From my own experience, the ability to distinguish between types and tokens has really helped clarify my thinking and the way I analyze arguments. How much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? There are 13 word tokens and 9 word types. What's the difference? Do you see the difference? A type is a standard sequence of letters or sounds that can be used repeatedly, and a token is a particular instantiation of a type. So going back to that, On the left, you see there were 13 distinct words. Those are tokens. And then you have 9 types. Some of those were used twice. For instance, Woodchuck. Woodchuck, used twice. And a couple others there. A type is a little like a Platonic form. It's an ideal, it's a norm, it's a stable universal, it's something that keeps on getting used. A token is just a particular instance. I just said a token is a particular instance. There, I said it again. Those are all tokens. Those are all token statements. You could actually have token statements. Look at these. By grace you've been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God. That's a type that gets used over and over and over and over again in token instances. This is just one. You can say it. You can read it in books. And depending on who's using it, it's going to have different meaning. You guys may know the Calvinist-Arminian dispute over this text. That not of yourselves. It is the gift. What is that? What is it? Is it the grace, says the Arminian, or is it the faith, says the Calvinist oftentimes? Walk by the Spirit and you will not carry out the desire of the flesh. What does walk by the Spirit mean? It's an important question. People use that statement all the time, but they have different meanings. Will not carry out the desire of the flesh. To what degree are we guaranteed some kind of overcoming of sin? Is this leading to perfectionism? How do we interpret this? This is my body. 4 different historic interpretations at the very least. Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Calvinist, Zwinglian. This is my body. The natural right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Who knows how many interpretations have been thrown on that one? God helps those who help themselves. How many of you recoil when you see that? Anyone? Okay. Yeah, I tend to recoil when I see that or hear that. But if you think about it, that could be adapted to a Christian view of things. God gives grace to those who humble themselves. All right? Maybe that's all I mean to say. And before you jump all over me, why don't you stop and ask, right? We've got to be so careful. We see these types, whether they're words or sentences, and we automatically pour this meaning into them, which, depending on the person and the context, really might not be there. In actual writing, debate, conversation, men reason by means of tokens. But the meaning of a token will depend partly, not wholly, but partly on the intentions and the context of the token user. Therefore, it is possible for two people to instantiate, I'm going to read this twice, it is possible for two different people to instantiate, that is to make an instance of, the same type with different intentions, such that the same type will have variations of meaning in different token instances. So one pastor gets up and says, this is my body, and the congregation more or less understands what he means because they're Lutheran. But they've got a Calvinist amongst them and a Zwinglian amongst them. And they're approaching this a little bit differently, aren't they? And we can go on with examples where, depending on the context, the person using it, you're going to have what's called the problem of ambiguity. That comes from a Latin word which means to wonder about. Okay? Makes sense, right? I think it's helpful for the students to understand some of the sources and causes of ambiguity. There are at least 6 more, I'm sure. One is, some dictionaries provide baseline definitions of word types, serving only to get us into the ballpark. Okay? One dictionary defines rights as a justified claim or justified demand. That's a pretty good definition. But when you study political philosophy and you realize they're 2 radically different and competing definitions of rights, which serve as the root of a whole debate about the meaning of justice and the role of government, it's not sufficient to talk about rights in the abstract. Are we talking about rights in the active sense? The justified demand to act without interference from others, or rights in the passive sense, the justified demand to receive assistance from others. The latter sense became very popular during the French Revolution and has since got a hold of our collective psyche, and it's at the base of a lot of left-wing political philosophies. It's the idea that rights and therefore justice gets cashed out in terms of rights of recipients, welfare rights, beneficiary rights, as opposed to liberty. More conservative, small or limited government theorists would hold to rights in this active sense. But if we're just talking about rights in the abstract, I'm a big champion of rights. Well, what do you mean by that? And rights for whom? For what? Right? It's an ambiguous expression. Some have a semantic range. I've already given you a big list of possible definitions of evolution. Huge semantic range. We have to be aware of that fact. Some word types are essentially equivocal. That means it's one word with two completely different meanings. Bat, B-A-T. Right? They have nothing in common with each other. Sometimes, though, words get really close to being equivocal. Take the word love. If I'm thinking of love in the sense of agape, of, say, an act of commitment to the well-being of others, despite my attraction to them, and sometimes, you know, think about a Christian who goes to prison to minister to a man who murdered his wife. And he's doing that to show the love of Christ. Right? Versus someone who says they think they finally love so-and-so after 8 months of dating and hanging out and so on. Right? Two completely different notions of love. One is completely effective and self-absorbed, having to do with the pleasure someone gives you based on their looks or personality. And one doesn't make reference to that. One is based on obedience to God to seek out the well-being of someone for the sake of Christ. And if we're not clear, those really should be two different terms. Two different terms. The similarity is so small that it really doesn't justify using one term, in my opinion, but we can have that debate. How about analogical terms? Doug Wilson talked about the revolution of America, the revolution of France. Revolution, very similar, but distinct. That's what analogical more or less means. Similar meanings, but distinct. God knows, I know. Similar meaning, but distinct. God does not learn. He does not infer things. Right? How about terms with huge theoretical and historic baggage? We throw these words around all the time, and depending on the sentence, I drive my friends crazy because what do you think about the Romanticism? What aspect of it? That's always my response. What aspect of it? What do you mean? Because it's heavily freighted. Take the word Reformation. If I say the Reformation was a blessing, the Reformation, I could think about that in a historic way, from the 15-teens to, say, the 1590s. I could think about it geographically, Germany, France, England, Scotland, Scandinavia. I can think about it theologically, Lutheran, Calvinist, Anabaptist maybe, the radical reformers, maybe even push it a little bit further to the Arminians, the Remonstrants, to the Anglicans maybe a little bit. What are we talking about here? Did the Reformation result in greater biblical literacy? Yes. Is that good? Yes. What about drowning Anabaptists? Is that part of the Reformation? Well, what do you mean? I need to know what you have in mind by Reformation. These terms are heavily freighted, and students need to be aware of the fact that they need to consider the possibility that these are multifaceted concepts and that they should be slow to jumping into a discussion about them and a debate about them. Some words have great emotional baggage. Teenager, dogmatic, retribution. Take retribution. That literally means just giving to someone their due, usually in a penal sense, with punishment. But oftentimes, retribution means for some people, what? Vengeance. bloodthirstiness, barbarism. But retribution is one of the most pristine moral concepts in our vocabulary, if you understand it correctly. It's what God gives us if we don't trust in Christ. It's retribution. It's giving us what's due to us, what we deserve. So when we come across words like this, we have to be aware that there is emotional baggage associated with them, and students need to be nuanced. They need to use discretion. They need to think about how this could come across to their audience, what could be brought to the table. Definition helps do this. Definition, it comes from a word which means to limit or to set boundaries to. It's the same word from which we get definite and definitive. And the idea is that you're trying to set clear boundaries so that you know if you're in or if you're out of the concept in the discussion. When I teach definition, one of the most important distinctions I make, this is moving on to Roman numeral 4, is between nominal and real definition. Sometimes these terms are used differently for a number of historic reasons, but I'm using it more as the medievals used it. A nominal definition is a name-oriented definition, and a real definition, you could say, is a thing-oriented definition. A nominal definition is designed to communicate a truth about the general usage of a word. A real definition, though, is meant to communicate truth about the reality signified by the word type. So, this might not seem like a big deal, since oftentimes these coincide. If I'm talking, you know, usually when we say sun, S-U-N, we're talking about the thing that we orbit around, and it's a star, and it's massive, and it's hot, and all the rest. And so the real definition and the common usage of the nominal definition coincide. And oftentimes that's the case. But sometimes it doesn't. Take the word marriage. Right? From a Christian standpoint, a real definition involves man and woman, and so on and so forth. But for some people, the nominal definition of marriage is growing more and more relativistic and open-ended. Take the word human. We're moving more and more towards a point in our history where the nominal definition of human has distinctly evolutionary meaning. One definition I came across of human: the only living species in the Homo genus of the bipedal primates in the Hominidae, or great ape family. Now, through education, that definition could get habituated into the minds of young people such that, over the long haul, that's also the nominal definition. It's not just a real definition from their standpoint. If you're an evolutionist, you think this is also a real definition. It's also now common usage. And as Christians, we have to teach students to be ready to fight those debates between nominal and real definitions. And the truth conditions are going to be different. If someone wants to argue for the nominal definition of human, as I've just defined it, then they have to just simply note that this is the way most people use it, or this is the way perhaps the dictionaries defined it. But if we're talking about the real definition, now we're going to get into worldview, philosophy, to science. Right? Real definition is about going out and seeing how things are and trying to represent them to ourselves. This is why I think Socrates is a great place to start. Going into the dialogues, the Socratic quest is really a quest for real definitions. The Socratic inquiry or methodology usually starts off with the what is X question. The second step is he'll elicit a provisional answer in the form of a connotative definition, which I'll explain momentarily. And then thirdly, he tests the definition with at least four principles. If you've read some of these dialogues, you know that, for instance, in the Euthyphro, he's trying to figure out what piety is. And Euthyphro tells him, it's what I'm doing right now, i.e. taking my father to court for murder. And Socrates, I'm going to read a passage here momentarily, says that's not what I'm looking for. But that's called a denotative definition in contrast to a connotative. I'm going to tell you what a connotative is momentarily, but it's in contrast to a denotative definition. If Euthyphro says, piety is what I'm doing right now, Socrates, he's pointing to a particular instance and saying this is a case of this thing called piety. Or in another dialogue, the Meno, they're trying to define virtue, and Meno says virtue is wisdom, justice, temperance, and courage. Right? And Socrates says, well, that's not quite what I'm looking for. That's also a denotative definition. It's by subclass. My colleague yesterday was asking, what is science? And we hadn't talked, but it worked perfectly. She was asking, what is science? And started off with, I believe, some denotative definitions along the lines of what Newton did. Right? What Newton did. What Harvey did. Those would be denotative definitions by examples. And then she said physics, biology, chemistry, denotation by subclass. And then she gave what's called a connotative definition. And I have that here because I went and got it from her. But I'm having a hard time finding it. Excuse me for that. In Socrates' case, what he wants is a connotative definition, that is, a definition which will capture the universal, that unites all of them together. Mrs. Duarte gave a connotative definition of science. I can't find it now, but it was a great definition that united all the different aspects of science together. Yes?
Science is man's study of God's art? That one?
No, is the third one, I think. Yeah, thank you, though. Thank you. But let's read this briefly. This is from the Euthyphro. Socrates speaks first. But just at present, I would rather hear from you a more precise answer, which you have not as yet given, my friend, to the question, what is piety? When asked, you only replied, doing as you do, charging your father with murder. And Euthyphro replies, and what I said was true, Socrates. No doubt, Euthyphro. But you would admit that there are many other pious acts. There are. Remember that I did not ask you to give me two or three examples of piety, but to explain the general idea which make all pious things to be pious. Do you not recollect that there was one idea which made the impious impious and the pious pious? I remember. Tell me what is the nature of this idea, and then I shall have a standard to which I may look, and by which I may measure actions, whether yours or those of anyone else, and then I shall be able to say that such and such an action is pious, such another impious. In my Great Ideas class, I do a segment on faith and reason, and I started off by watching that great scene from the Last Crusade, where Indy is stepping out over that gorge, and they show him. He's just gone through this gauntlet, and they show him with his father's book, and he's looking at this thing and just sees a guy stepping out, and he just like this, and he steps out, and then this thing, this bridge pops up, and the music gets really dramatic, and he walks across. And I ask the students, is that faith in the biblical sense? Is that? I'm pointing to a particular example, ostensive, right? Is that biblical faith? And then we debate it for 2 days. We discuss it for 2 days. And that gets them all over the map on this. They're not clear. Some of them say yeah, some say no, some say a little bit, but they're just not really clear because they don't have this one idea, this one standard notion, this universal, which would enable them to say of any particular that it is indeed biblical faith. That's the idea. And so we study out the biblical idea of faith. And we revisit the video, and they're much more definitive in the way that they answer that question because they have a better idea of what biblical faith means. It's the importance of definition. Here's the definition that Donna gave. Science, a branch of study dedicated to the accumulation and classification of observable facts in order to formulate general laws about the natural world. It's a pretty good definition. But look how universal it is. It's a branch of study. What kind? Dedicated to the accumulation and classification of observable facts. Why? In order to formulate general laws about the natural world. That would capture what Newton's doing. It would capture what Harvey's doing. It would capture physics, chemistry, biology. Socrates expresses great satisfaction when he gets these sorts of answers. In the Euthyphro, he finally gets the definition of piety as what is dear to the gods. In the Meno, he gets virtue as the power of governing mankind. And then the Theaetetus, he gets the definition of knowledge as true belief in the Republic. On and on, he gets these different definitions. Those are connotative. And only when he gets the connotative definition does he feel ready to start his next step, which is to test them. The mere fact that you get a connotative definition doesn't mean it's good. And so he goes on to test them. And his procedure, this is just my personal take on teaching through the dialogues, is more or less fourfold. The ability for the definition to cover all the things meant by the class term. 2, the ability of the definition to cover only the things meant by the class term. 3, the ability to capture the essence of the thing. And 4, the logical consistency of the implications of that definition with other known facts or beliefs. So looking at 1, here's a rule breaker of this first principle. A triangle is a plane figure bounded by 3 straight lines of equal length. Why does that not cover all triangles? Yeah. This defines equilateral, but it leaves out scaling and isosceles, right? Right, Linda? its ability to cover only. So if I say a triangle is a plane figure bounded by straight lines, I'm also including what? Yeah, all sorts of things. But the mere fact that it covers all and only doesn't yet mean it's satisfactory to him. So take the definition of human as an animal with a sense of humor. Assuming animals taken in some generic way, I think we could say, yeah, all men are animals with a sense of humor, except for maybe Germans, and that only humans are animals with a sense of humor, but would you buy that as a definition of man? See, Socrates would say, you've pointed out a property. A property is something that goes along with the essence. The ability to solve geometrical problems is a property. But a property of what? A property of the nature, i.e. rationality, which distinguishes us from other creatures. That's the idea. We laugh because we're rational. We're not rational because we laugh. So one's more basic than the other. And then the logical consistency of the implications. Socrates is wonderful for this particular point. Say Euthyphro's definition of piety is what is dear to the gods. Socrates says, well, but aren't there many gods? Yeah. And don't they like different things? Yeah. So then what's pious to Zeus is not pious to Apollo? Yeah. Scratch that one. Or what is justice? It's giving to each what is their own. Okay, so if a man lent you his weapon and now he's psychotic and he wants to kill someone with it, is it just to return the weapon to him? Well, maybe not, right? So he gets these connotative definitions and then he tests them, he thinks them through, and he realizes oftentimes they lead to inconsistencies with other principles. And so he's trying to find not just what is essential, but also, or in the process of finding what's essential, he wants to find what is consistent, because he has great faith in the internal consistency of the world, the coherence of the world. He doesn't buy contradictions. All right, moving on to different forms and methods of definition. You guys are familiar with probably the most common. It's often called definition by genus and specific difference. I don't want to spend much time on this. It's pretty straightforward. The definition of a triangle, say, is a plane figure bounded by 3 straight lines. The idea here is that to get one of these definitions, you're trying to find the proximum genus. It's the category such as the third bullet. It's the nearest category under which the thing falls. So if you go too high, say by defining triangle as a figure, you're at the level of summum genus. And then you can have this range of subaltern genera in the middle. What kind of figure? A plane figure. Yeah, that's true, but still not specific enough, right? Species-ific enough. It's not species-ific enough. What kind of plane figure? A plane figure bounded by straight lines. That's getting better. That's probably, you could argue this one, but it's probably the proximum genus. A triangle is in the category of plane figures bounded by straight lines. Now, how do you separate those from, say, squares or pentagons? By the number of lines. And that's called the specific difference. And so you find the proximum genus, and then you bring in the specific difference to carve that up, and somehow you get this definition, which is supposed to be the essence of the thing. There's a lot of value to this, but also some big problems. For the sake of time, I'm going to skip those problems, though. I'd be happy to chat with you or send you a list of what I think are the problems, and it's not just my thoughts. They're more like limitations. They're more just limitations. I think we've got to teach the kids that this isn't the only way of defining things. And sometimes, I mean, a platypus, come on. How do you apply this to a platypus, right? I could go on with all sorts of problems, but I want to jump to another method using conditions. I find this one very helpful. This is a method of conditionals. You take a term, say marriage, and you want to figure out how to narrow it down by identifying as many necessary conditions as possible for something to be marriage. Okay? So, for starters, obviously it's got to be a relationship. X can't be a marriage unless it's a relationship of some sort. Okay, so you have the only if. That expresses a necessary condition. A necessary condition is that without which something can't be, say, a marriage. Okay? So that's a good start. What else must be present? Well, here's some other things. Between persons, obviously. Between opposite sexes. Between only two persons. Intended to be a lifelong commitment, perhaps. Sexually exclusive. So now we have five more. And so you can, if you look at the expression at the bottom, X is a marriage only if X is all of those things. But is that still enough? So far, this really, if you think about it, this also covers, domestic relationships, right? You can have a man and a woman committing for life to live together, in a sexually exclusive relationship. That's not a marriage yet. So you have all those necessary conditions which need to be there, but you still see that they're not what? Sufficient. They're still not sufficient. We need to keep pouring in more necessary conditions. So let's say we have something like officially formalized or recognized by God or the state or something like that, and call that G. We'll call that condition G. What we do now is we formulate this as a... I just jumped ahead a little bit. Sorry about that. Let's say we just have our initial six conditions, A through F. You test this by putting it into a sufficient condition. If X is A, B, C, D, E, F, then it is a marriage. And you ask yourself, is that true? And you apply the all and only principle. Well, does it cover all marriages? Yes. But does it cover only marriages? We would say no, because this covers also what we just said, live-in domestic relationships. So this is where we throw in another condition about it being formally sanctioned or ratified. We'll call that condition G. And then we say, once we get everything there, we put it into what's called a biconditional. X is a marriage if and only if X is all of those things, A through G. Or, more simply, marriage just equals all of those things. And the students love this method. It gets them thinking about what is necessary. What do I really essentially mean when I use this concept? And we get in some fun debates with this. Moving on to my last point here, worldview. Definitions are so important to the task of inculcating a Christian worldview, guys. A few things that came to mind here from my experience in the classroom. First of all, teaching the students to use definition constructively. If you look at that passage, Paul's criticizing those who engage in verbal disputes beyond what's proper and creating division and schism and bitterness and so on. And so we need to be critical. And this is the paradox, isn't it, of teaching these guys. We want them to be critical. We want them to tear things down in some sense, and so, but they can build them back up. And oftentimes they don't get that second part. They just want to keep on ripping things into shreds and analyzing stuff. And we want to teach them that it's a scalpel. A scalpel is very, very constructive through what? Destruction, right? You cut in order to repair. And that's sort of how definition is. We need to get these kids to define everything under the light of the word. Our last speaker was talking about gender. There's a huge debate right now. I'm embroiled in something along these lines of this debate between sex and gender. In secular academia, they want to say that sex is male and female, gender, man, woman. Sex, male and female, is natural, biological, but gender, man and woman, are totally cultural, relative. And so they want to bend and mold gender into whatever they want it to be. So you can be a male, you can be a male woman, right? A male woman. Male sex, but a gender of a woman. That's a fight over our definition there. We need to be willing to say, no, there is a real gender distinction that is attached to sexuality, to male and female. Defining everything under the word. Overcoming modern dichotomies between faith and reason, science and philosophy, church culture, piety, politics. How many times do people take conceptual distinctions? They're real conceptual distinctions, say, between science and philosophy. And then they turn them into these actual walls of separation. Do you see the difference? There's a distinction between physics and chemistry. But it's a conceptual distinction. It has bearing in reality to some degree, but you can't just put this wall of separation. Those things are so heavily integrated. And the more you think Christianly, the more you realize everything's integrated. Everything's meshed together. The word coherence comes from the same word we get the word plywood. It means something like this. It's all stuck together. Definitions help students to see that. To detect question-begging definitions, oftentimes people define miracle as a violation of the laws of nature. Well, that's totally question-begging. Why? Doesn't that just lock God out of his universe when you use that kind of language? I could go on talking about how that more or less assumes a deistic worldview, as opposed to, say, an exception in God's ordinary providence. Or something along those lines. If we buy certain definitions that are loaded, we will lose the debate. We've got to challenge reductionist definitions. People want to define thought as a neural bit of motion in the brain. That's a reductionist definition. And by the way, when we challenge reductionist definitions, one of the things we need to do is get the kids to see that reality is multifaceted. Think about water. If someone were to say, water is not really the liquidy, clear, cool stuff. It's really just H2O. He would say, no, it's both. It's both. Why do you want to make the reduction? Why do you want to do that? It's both. You can see things from different perspectives, different aspects. God, we're ontological pluralists as Christians. God created a very, very complex world. And definitions help us to capture that fact. You can define things in terms of genetics, but you can also define things in terms of just observation as well. So a duck could be something with a bill, right? A bird with a bill or whatever. But you could also give a genetic definition. Both of those are valid. You're just looking at it from different perspectives. Or to unmask euphemistic terms. I just recently, someone said they had a friend who had narcissistic personality syndrome. And I thought to myself, isn't that just self-idolatry? Isn't that just sin? Right? So hopefully, I know I've hosed you here with a lot of information, but hopefully this will be helpful for you to be thinking about how you can incorporate some of these these ideas into your own class. And I can just tell you to finish up that I've seen real fruit in my classes as a result of spending a great deal of time on definition, even in this conference, because I'm so sensitive to this topic, speaking on it, over and over and over again in my conversations with y'all and listening to the presentations, I just see the importance of this. So I hope this is helpful for you. If you have any questions, I guess we've got 4 minutes. Do any of you have questions? Otherwise, feel free to leave. I'll stick around.